Can you hear me? In the park, I want to ask how far can we go in our search for understanding and knowledge? Will we ever find the complete form of the law of the nature? By a complete form, I mean a set of rules that, in principle at least, enable us to predict the future through necessary accuracy, knowing the state of the universe at one time. A qualitative understanding of the law has been the aim of philosophers and scientists from Aristotle onward. But it was Newton's Principia Mathematica in 1687, containing the theory of universal gravitation, that made the law of quantitative and precise. The threat of the idea of scientific determinism, which seemed first to have been expressed by Laplace. If at one time one knew the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe, the laws of science could enable us to calculate their positions and velocities at any other time, past or future. The law may or may not have been ordained by God, but scientific determinism asserts that He does not intervene to break them. At first, it seemed that his hope for a complete determinism would be dashed by the discovery early in the 20th century that events like the decay of radioactive atoms seemed to take place at random. It was that the thought was claimed by the Einstein phrase. But science changed defeat into victory by moving the goalposts and redefining what it meant by a complete knowledge of the universe. It was the guilt of brilliance whose philosophical implications have still not been fully appreciated. Much of the credit belonging to Paul Dirac, my predecessor but one in the Lacazan chair, though it wasn't notarized in his time. idea that shows how the work of Irwin flows in your inner Heisenberg could be combined in the new picture of reality called quantum theory. In quantum theory, a particle is not characterized by three quantities, its position and its velocity, as in classical Newtonian theory. Instead, it is described by a single quantity, the wave function. The size of the wave function at a point gives the probability that the particle will be found at that point, and the rate at which the wave function changes from point to point gives the probability of different velocities. One can have a wave function that is partly peaked at a point. This corresponds to a state in which there is little uncertainty in the position of the particle. However, the wave function varies rapidly, so there is a lot of uncertainty in the velocity. Similarly, a long chain of waves has a large uncertainty in position, but a small uncertainty in velocity. One can have a well-defined position or a well-defined velocity, but not both. This would seem to make complete determinism impossible. If one can accurately define both the position and the velocity of particles at one time, how can one predict what they will be in the future? It is like weather forecasting. The forecasters don't have an accurate knowledge of the atmosphere at one time. Not a few measurements at ground level and which can be learned from satellite photographs. That's why weather forecasts are so unreliable. However, in quantum theory, it turns out one doesn't need to know both the position and the velocity. If one knew the laws of physics and the wave function at one time, then something called the Schrödinger equation will tell one how fast the wave function was changing with time. This would allow one to calculate the wave function at any other time. One can therefore claim that there is still determinism, but it is a determinism on a reduced level. Instead of being able accurately to predict true quantity, position and velocity, one can predict only a single quantity, the wave function. We have redefined determinism to be just half of what Laplace thought it was. Some people have tried to connect the unpredictability of the other half with consciousness or the intervention of supernatural beings. But it is difficult to make either case for something that is completely random. In order to calculate how the wave function develops in time, one needs the quantum law that governs the universe. So how well do we know these laws? As Dirac remarked, Maxwell's equations of light and the relativistic wave equation, which he was too modest to call the Dirac equation, govern most of physics and all of chemistry and biology. So in principle, we ought to be able to predict human behavior, though I can't say I have had much success myself. The trouble is that the human brain contains far too many particles for us to be able to solve the equation. But it is comforting to think we might be able to predict an emerald worm, even if we can't quite figure out humans. Quantum theory and the Maxwell and Dirac equations indeed govern much of our life, but there are two important areas beyond their scope. One is the nuclear forces. The other is gravity. The nuclear forces are responsible for the sun shining and the formation of the elements, including the carbon and oxygen of which we are made. And gravity caused the formation of stars and planets, and indeed, of the universe itself. So it is important to bring them into the scheme. The so-called weak nuclear forces have been unified with the Maxwell equations by Atlas Solomon and Steven Weinberg in what is known as the electroweak theory. The predictions of the theory have been confirmed by experiments and the authors rewarded with Nobel Prizes. The remaining nuclear forces, the so-called ground forces, have not yet been successfully unified with the electroweak forces in an observationally tested scheme. Instead, they seem to be described by a similar but separate theory called UCD. It is not clear who, if anyone, could get an adult life for UCD, but David Wilson, who worked as you, earned credit for showing the theory gets simpler at high energies. I had quite a job to get my deep synthesizer to pronounce Merritt's surname. It wasn't familiar with that part of ET. The electroweak theory and QCD together constitute a so-called standard model of particle physics which aims to describe everything except gravity. The standard model seems to be adequate for all practical purposes, at least for the next 100 years. But practical or economic reasons have never been the driving force in our search for a complete theory of the universe. No one working on the basic theory from Galileo onward have carried out their research to make money, the Dirac would have made a fortune if he had patented the Dirac equation. He would have had a royalty on every television, Walkman, video game, and computer. The real reason we are seeking a complete theory is that we want to understand the universe and feel we are not just the victims of dark and mysterious forces. If we understand the universe, then we control it, in a sense. The standard model is clearly unsatisfactory in this respect. First of all, it is mostly in ad hoc. The particles are grouped in an apparently arbitrary way, and the standard model depends on 24 numbers, whose values cannot be deduced from first principles, but which have to be taken to fit the observations. What understanding is there in that? Can it be made of that word? The second failing of the standard model is that it does not include gravity. Instead, gravity has to be described by Einstein's general theory of relativity. General relativity is not a quantum theory, unlike the law that governs everything else in the universe. Although it is not consistent to use the non-quantum general relativity with the quantum standard model, this has no practical significance at the present stage of the universe, because gravitational fields are so weak. However, in the very early universe, gravitational fields would have been much stronger, and quantum gravity would have been significant. Indeed, we have evidence that quantum uncertainty in the old universe made some regions slightly more or less dense than the otherwise uniform background. We can see this in small differences in the background of microwave radiations in different directions. The hotter, denser regions will condense out of the expansion of galaxies, stars, and planets. All the collectors in the universe, including ourselves, can be traced back to quantum effects in the very early stages. It is therefore essential to have a fully consistent quantum theory of gravity if we are to understand the universe. Constructing a quantum theory of gravity has been the outstanding problem in theoretical physics for the last 30 years. It is much, much more difficult than the quantum theories of the quantum molecular weak forces. We propagate in a fixed background of space and time. One can define the wave function and use the Schrodinger equation to evolve it in time. But according to general relativity, gravity is space and time. So how can the wave function for gravity evolve in time? And anyway, what does one mean by the wave function for gravity? It turns out that, in the formal sense, one can define a wave function and a Schrodinger-like equation for gravity, but that they are of little use in actual calculations. Instead, the usual approach is to regard the quantum spacetime as the small perturbation of some background spacetime, generally flat space. The perturbations can then be treated as quantum fields, like the electroweak and QCD fields, propagating through the background spacetime. In calculations of perturbations, there is generally some quantity called the effective coupling, which measures how much of an extra perturbation a disturbance generates. If the coupling is small, a small perturbation creates a smaller correction, which gives an even smaller second correction, and so on. Perturbation theory works and can be used to calculate to any degree of accuracy. An example is the Urbanch account. The interest on the account is the small perturbation. A very small perturbation if you are with one of the Big Bangs. The interest is compound. That is, there is interest on the interest, and interest on the interest on the interest. However, the amounts are tiny. To a good approximation, the money in your account is what you put there. On the other hand, if the coupling is high, a perturbation generates a larger perturbation, which then generates an even larger perturbation. An example would be borrowing money from loan sharks. The interest can be more than you borrowed, and then you pay interest on that. It is disastrous. With gravity, the effective coupling is the energy or mass of the perturbation, because it determines how much it works spacetime, and so creates a further perturbation. However, in quantum theory, quantities like the electric field or the geometry of spacetime don't have definite values, but have what are called quantum fluctuations. These fluctuations have energy. In fact, they have an infinite amount of energy because there are fluctuations on all length scales, no matter how small. Not treating quantum gravity as the perturbation of flat space doesn't work well because the perturbations are strongly coupled. Supergravity was invented in 1976 to solve, or at least improve, the energy problem. It is the combination of general relativity with other fields, such that each species of particle has the super partner species. The energy of the quantum fluctuations of one partner is positive and the other negative, so they tend to cancel. It was hoped the infinite positive and negative energy would cancel completely, leaving only a finite remainder. In this case, a perturbation treatment would work, because the effective coupling would be weak. However, in 1985, people suddenly lost confidence that the infinities would cancel. This was not because anyone had shown that they definitely didn't cancel. It was reckoned it would take a good graduate student 300 years to do the calculation, and how would one know they hadn't made a mistake on page 2? Rather, it was because Ned Witten declared that string theory was a true quantum theory of gravity, and supergravity was not an approximation valid when particle energies are low, which in practice, they always are. in string theory, gravity is not thought of as the working of spacetime. Instead, it is given by string diagrams, networks of pipes that represent little loops of string propagating through flat spacetime. The effective coupling that gives the strength of the junction where three pipes meet is not the energy as it is in supergravity. Instead, it is given by what is called the dilaton, a field that has not been observed. If the dilaton had a low value, the effective coupling would be weak, and string theory would be a good quantum theory. But it is no earthly use for practical purposes. In the years since 1985, we have realized that both supergravity and string theory belong to a larger collector known as Venn theory. While it would be called Venn theory is completely obscure. Venn theory is not a theory in the usual sense. Rather, it is the collection of theories that look very different, but which describe the same physical situation. The theories are related by mapping, or correspondences, called dualities, which imply that they are all reflections of the same underlying theory. Each theory in the collection works well in the limit, like low energy or low dilaton, in which its effective coupling is small, but breaks down when the coupling is large. This means that none of the theories can predict the future of the universe to arbitrary accuracy. For that, one would need a single formulation of Venn theory that would work in all situations. Up to now, most people have implicitly assumed that there is an ultimate theory that we will eventually discover. Indeed, I myself have suggested we might find it quite soon. However, Venn theory has made me wonder if this is true. Maybe it is not possible to formulate the theory of the universe in a finite number of statements. This is very reminiscent of Gödel's theorem. This says that any finite system of axioms is not sufficient to prove every result in mathematics. Gödel's theorem is proved using statements that refer to themselves. Such statements can lead to paradoxes. An example is, the statement is false. If the statement is true, it is false. And if the statement is false, it is true. Another example is, the barber of course who saves every man who does not save himself. Who saves saves the barber. If he saves himself, then he doesn't, and if he doesn't, then he does. Joel went a great length to avoid that error reduction by carefully distinguishing between mathematics, like 2 plus 2 equals 4, and metamathematics, or statements about mathematics, such as mathematics is cool, or mathematics is consistent. That is why his paper is so difficult to read. But the idea is quite simple. First, Gödel showed that each mathematical formula, like 2 plus 2 equals 4, can be given a unique number, the Gödel number. The Gödel number of 2 plus 2 equals 4 is enormous. Second, the metamathematical statement, the sequence of formulas A, is the proof of the formula B, can be expressed as the mathematical relation between the Gödel numbers for A and B. Thus, metamathematics can be mapped into arithmetic, though I'm not sure how you translate a metamathematical statement, mathematics is cool. Third and last, consider the self-referring Gödel statement, B. This is, the statement B cannot be demonstrated from the axioms of mathematics. Suppose that B could be demonstrated. Then the axioms must be inconsistent, because one could both demonstrate B and say that it cannot be demonstrated. On the other hand, if B can't be demonstrated, then B is true. By the mapping into numbers, it corresponds to a true relation between numbers, but one which cannot be deduced from the axioms. Thus, mathematics is either inconsistent or incomplete. The smart money is an incomplete.